Through it, as we have looked at those opening visions and we have thought about how they teach us about God's sovereignty and his presence even in a foreign land, his control of events, as we went through last week the chapters on the judgment to Israel, and we've seen how that acted as a kind of apologetic by God to show that the judgment that he was bringing in Israel was absolutely justified and absolutely appropriate, and be able to understand why so much time is taken going through all the sins of Israel in those chapters, and of course that it will point you ultimately to the wonder of the gospel as you reflect on the depths of sin. We're going to read together in chapter 34 of Ezekiel. We're going to look at this last section of the book tonight. Chapter 34, I'm going to read from by way of introduction. It's on page 865 of the Red Pew Bible. Well-known passage where God addresses the false shepherds of Israel. Chapter 34. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to the shepherds of Israel who only take care of themselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak or healed the sick or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally, so they were scattered because there was no shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered all over the mountains and in every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, because my flock lacks a shepherd, and so has been plundered, and has become food for all the wild animals, and because my shepherds do not search for my flock, but cared for themselves rather than for my flock. Therefore, O shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against the shepherds, and will hold them accountable for my flock. I will remove them from tending the flock, so that the shepherds can no longer feed themselves. I will rescue my flock from their mouths, and it will no longer be food for them. For this is what the sovereign Lord says. I myself will search for my sheep and look after them, as a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them. So I will look after my sheep. I will rescue them from all the places where they were scattered on a day of clouds and darkness. I will bring them out from the nations and gather them from the countries, and I will bring them into their own land. I will pasture them in the mountains of Israel, in the ravines, and in all the settlements in the land. I will tend them in a good pasture, and the mountain heights of Israel will be their grazing land. There they will lie down in good grazing land, and there they will feed in a rich pasture in the mountains of Israel. I myself will tend my sheep and make them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord. I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak, but the sleek and the strong I will destroy. I am the shepherd. I will shepherd the flock with justice. As for you, my flock, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I will judge between one sheep and another, and between rams and goats. Is it not enough for you to feed in the good pasture? Must you also trample the rest of your pasture with your feet? Is it not enough for you to drink clear water? Must you also muddy the rest with your feet? Must my flock feed on what you have trampled and drink what you have muddied with your feet? Therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says to them. See, I myself will judge between the fat sheep and the lean sheep, because you shove with flank and shoulder, butting all the weak sheep with your horns until you have driven them away. I will save my flock, and they will no longer be plundered. I will judge between one sheep and another. I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he will tend them. He will tend them and be their shepherd. I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. May God bless to us the reading of his holy words. Last week was quite grueling in many ways. If you were here, it was a tough section to cover. But as I said in the introduction, the intensity of that study on the sin of Israel as it is outlined in the first 24 chapters of the book points us to the wonder of the gospel, to the love of God for sinners, that in the face of that kind of sin, the kind of sin that we are responsible for in our own lives, Jesus still came and died for us. As the old Puritans used to say, till sin be bitter, Christ is not sweet. Well, we noted last week, and I think in week one as well, that the turning point of Ezekiel chronologically comes in chapter 33. If you look at chapter 33 and verses 21 to 22 with me, we'll see there that this is when news arrives to the exiles. In the 12th year of our exile, in the 10th month, on the 5th day, a man who had escaped from Jerusalem came to me and said, "The city has fallen." Now the evening before the man arrived, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he opened my mouth before the man came to me in the morning. So my mouth was opened, and I was no longer silent. Jerusalem has fallen. It has met its final and total destruction. It was the end of an era, the end of an epoch. Yes, Jerusalem had been besieged in the past. It had been compromised before. Yes, it had been a place throughout its history of conflicts and coups. It had been subject to powerful neighbours and manipulated in all kinds of ways. Yes, all kinds of sins and terrible things had gone on there. But it always stood. It had always survived. It was the place where the temple was. It was God's city. And now with the vision in chapter 11 of God's glory departing from the temple and from Jerusalem, and with the temple itself now having been demolished, this was really a kind of theological meltdown for Jewish people of the time. All the covenant curses, all those curses in Deuteronomy, which God had said would happen if they turned away from him, if they didn't follow him, that they'd be thrown out of the land, have all now come to pass and been fulfilled. All the warnings have been realized. Everything that Israel took pride in, everything that made them special, the promised land, the temple, had now been swept away. It was a moment, it seemed, when perhaps the great covenant experiment started at Mount Sinai had bitten the dust once and for all. And of course, we can look back on this now, can't we? And we are quite philosophical about it, because we know and we can see from our vantage point that this was just another episode, a momentous episode certainly, but just another episode in the story of God's unbroken work in the world to bring about salvation for his people, to recover that paradise that had been lost in Eden. But for Ezekiel back then and for the exiles, they couldn't be quite so sanguine about it. Because for them, Jerusalem was the key. It had such significance in how they thought about God and their relationship to him, about God's work in the world. For Jews, Mount Zion, where the temple was in the heart of Jerusalem, that was the mountain of God. That was the place where God dwelt. The Jews in Jesus' day had such a strong feeling about Jerusalem and the temple that they equated any suggestion that the temple might be destroyed with nothing less than the end of the world. Matthew chapter 24. Even today, Jerusalem for religious Jews is indivisible from their sense of identity, from their sense of faith and purpose and God's calling upon them. And so when the exiles hear this breathless messenger arriving from Jerusalem and breaking the news of the destruction of the city and of the temple, it would be a real crisis moment for them. And it should be for us as well as we're reading through Ezekiel, if we can put ourselves in their shoes. Because nothing less than the fate of the world hangs on this moment. On the question of, is this the end of God's work in the world? Is this the death of all those promises made to Abraham? That through Abraham, through that people, through that covenant, that agreement made at Mount Sinai, God was going to work out a way to bless all the nations of the world? Had that really now been extinguished? But God, as he so often does, as he characteristically does, at the moment of greatest despair, when things seem to have got to very rock bottom, at that very moment starts in his grace and his mercy to pick up the pieces again. And in the darkness of this moment, there are now glimmers of hope in Ezekiel. And from chapter 34 onwards, after this great announcement, God begins to map out a new future for Israel. And in chapter 34, he addresses, as we read, the problem of Israel's leadership, the shepherds of his people, the corrupt kings, and even worse, the self-interested priests who had exploited God's people all those centuries, verses 2 to 4. The result was a people, the sheep as they are described, who were scattered, verse 6. Who were vulnerable, verse 8, who were injured, verse 16. Notice even among the flock that there are abuses. Even sheep to sheep, we might say, there are problems. Verse 16, where they are butting each other out the way. Sheep and goats, lean and fat, strong and weak, cajoling, rivalry. Striving against each other. This isn't just a leadership issue. It runs from top to bottom of the people of God. Of course, this concern about shepherding and about relationships between God's people is a focus, it's a theme, a principle that runs throughout the entire Bible from Old Testament to New Testament. There's firstly, of course, the responsibility that leaders have for the care of God's people. We, in our economic theories today, I think there was a shift in the 19th century in terms of economic theories, but don't quote me on that, just something I picked up from somebody once. But certainly in our world today, we tend to see people in kind of economic terms and in business terms as a resource. And there's probably some usefulness in terms of business and the economy in doing that. So we tend to look at the things in society and we see people and fields and cows and crops and the rest of it. And they're kind of resources which people move about, kind of entrepreneurs. They are resources to be used and put to work. And as I say, that might have some validity, I'm sure it does, in the economy and in business. But the problem is, of course, that because we grew up in that kind of society and we're all educated with that kind of mindset and that outlook, it is very easy for us to see each other as a resource. It's very easy for pastors to see themselves as a kind of CEO figure in a church, or elders to think of themselves as managers. But God's people are not a resource, and churches are not companies. We are not to see each other any more as a resource than we would see our own families as a resource, that we would look at our own children or brothers and sisters and evaluate them in terms of being a workforce. Because of course the danger is, as the shepherds of Israel had done, that when you start to look at God's people through those eyes, then the strong, the healthy, the rich will be prioritised. They will get the attention and the time and the care. Because, of course, those are the ones who will most enhance and give you rewards as a CEO. If you lead or you minister in any capacity in church and the Christian life, the Bible's very strong to say to us that we have to show no favouritism. We've not to have worldly ambition in that sense. There's to be no sense among the people of God that some are more valuable or others are dispensable compared to the rest. But also, along with leadership, there is biblical instructions to how the sheep are to relate to each other. And of course, we're all sheep at the end of the day. There should be no competition, no selfish interest among us. We saw that, didn't we, in the passage, verse 21. Some of the healthy and strong sheep were barging the weaker sheep out of the way. Always the danger when we come to church of a mindset that says, what am I going to get out of this? Or what benefits do I get from being here? I've sometimes joked about it before, you know, coming to church and as the chairman or the preacher gets up to speak, sitting thinking, well, this better be good. We've got to avoid that kind of mindset altogether. Because if we don't, we'll end up pushing our preferences, our convenience, seeking our advantage over that of others. And it means that some sheep are going to be fat and well-tended and others are just going to get pushed out the way all the time. And in chapter 34, and we need to take these chapters to heart, we see God's disgust and anger at seeing his flock so unequal with such bias at work within it. Now, of course, any individual believer might need more care and attention at some point in their life than others. But Jesus warns us not to be like the pagans, not just to be looking after our friends and those who are like us. Such an easy, tempting thing to fall into. Jesus talks about how the pagans look after their friends and their relatives. He says, well, big deal, that's just what everybody does because they'll look after you. The challenge is to look after those who aren't like you, to care for those who are different, to go after the ones who won't reciprocate, who give you no benefit in return. And it points us back to the self-givingness of God himself. We read about it in chapter 34. Points us forward to the self-givingness of the gospel. Jesus, who accommodates himself to us, who becomes like us, who stands in our place. Gospel isn't a call to pull yourself up to God, but a gift of one who came down to us, who came not to serve, but to be served. And we see this in chapter 34, where the human shepherding has failed, and where it will continue to fail, no doubt, at various levels. God himself is going to provide a new shepherd for his people. Verses 23 to 24. A Davidic shepherd. A shepherd from the line of David. I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he will tend them. He will tend them and be their shepherd. I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. Shepherd who's going to be not just a shepherd, but a prince. A shepherd who will not fail the people. And of course, we can see, can't we, again, from our vantage point, how that human and divine shepherd was going to come together. How both God and man would shepherd the people of God and Jesus Christ. Who that shepherd king from the line of David would be. The shepherd who wasn't just going to care for the sheep, but was going to lay down his life for them. The shepherd who wasn't just going to be content with the 99 sheep that were safe and well in the pen, but would go out and search all night for the one that was lost. The shepherd who would lead his people to good pastures, who will bind up their wounds, who will guard their souls from the enemies that would assault them. Jesus Christ, as Peter puts it in his letter, for you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. We each, of course, have a responsibility, as I've just said, and an accountability indeed before God to care for each other. Not to be biased, not to be partial, not to ride roughshod over people who are easy to push out the way in our Christian relationships, in all our relationships. But of course, our ultimate hope, our ultimate comfort, our ultimate friend, our ultimate source of strength, our great shepherd, is not any other individual. It is Jesus Christ himself. Christians and elders, believe me, will disappoint and fail you, just as you will let them down in turn. Christians who are in solitary confinement, as many have experienced in other parts of the world, miss out on great blessings, but they are not alone. They are not without a shepherd, and neither are you, whatever your circumstance or situation tonight. During the summer, I went to a church and I heard a sermon about the church's responsibilities very much in the social sphere. And it was true as far as it went, all about the things that the church should be doing, the church should do this and the church should do that. But there was a crucial omission in it all. It was Jessica, my wife, who put her finger on it when we came out, that it never took people to Jesus. They gave the example of a kind of stereotypical old lady living down the road and how the church needed to be going out and doing this for her and providing this and meeting this need. And that's true. But crucially, what that old lady needs before anything else is to know Jesus Christ in her life for herself. Because the church isn't going to save her. The church can't be an everlasting hope. The church isn't going to provide for her soul in those moments when she will be alone. And if tonight your faith is in some way in Greenview, in the church, if your happiness is linked to the attentions of others, if your hope is in finding the ideal church where everything's done the way that you like it, if your confidence or assurance as a Christian is tied to a series of really awesome church services, then let me say tonight, you are only ever one thoughtless comment, one cold shoulder, one naff sermon, one flat prayer time, one overtired and stressed church member away from a crisis in your faith. But if Christ is your anchor, if he is your source of assurance and reassurance, then you have a shepherd who will not let you down, who will never turn you away, who's never going to disappoint you, who always understands, who is always true, who is always for you, and who is always with you. That needs to be your shepherd. Above and beyond anything else, the most encouraging, faithful friend will not meet your needs ultimately, but Jesus will. We need to press on because these remaining chapters are full of hope. Over to chapter 37, the famous vision of the Valley of Dry Bones, one of the best known bits in Ezekiel. And it starts with a question. Could it be possible for Israel to live again? We have said it appears to be covenantally dead. Verse 3, the Lord asked Ezekiel, can these bones live? You see, every indicator of spiritual life, every indicator of promise and blessing for Israel is at zero at this point. In my first draft of the notes, I had said that if Israel was a dead body, the graph would be flat and there'd be no beep. It would just be a steady tone coming from the machine. But actually, if only Israel was a dead body, it's actually far beyond being a dead body. It is a pile of dry bones. It is as barren and as far from signs of life as it is possible to imagine. And the question is, can these bones live? And Ezekiel wisely replies that that is a matter that ultimately only God can pronounce on. Verse 3, Sovereign Lord, you alone know. Of course, God can bring life from barrenness. He did that in the beginning. That's not the issue. The issue is, will he? Will he bring life back from the deadness that has become Israel? Just a note on how that new life then is imparted. Because we know, of course, that he does. He raises Israel from that metaphorical, from that spiritual death. We saw something of this when we looked at the subject of words a few weeks ago at the start of January in the morning service. Look at verse 5. God will make a breath or a spirit come upon them to revive them. And we see very vividly, don't we, that spiritual life is going to be a work of God through the Spirit, that as God breathes, as that breath, as that wind. It's a Hebrew word, ruach, and it can mean breath or wind or spirit, and they're used interchangeably. As that comes upon them, as God breathes, life will be imparted to these dead bones and they will live again. Spiritual life is a work of God by the Spirit. It's what we read in John chapter 3, isn't it? Verse 7 to 8. When Jesus says, "You should not be surprised at my saying, you must be born again. The wind blows wherever it pleases. You hear its sound, but you cannot tell where it comes from or where it is going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit." Spiritual life is a gift, a work of God's Holy Spirit as he breathes into the deadness of hearts that are captive to sin. But even as the Spirit breathes, even as God's Spirit brings about that new life, it's not the case that Ezekiel is somehow passive in this process. It's not just a case of Ezekiel, just stand over there and wait and see if God's going to revive Israel or bring again life to this dead nation. But actually, Ezekiel has a part to play. He is to prophesy. He is to speak to these dead bones. See that in verse 4. "Then he said to me, 'Prophesy to these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. I will make breath enter you, and you will come to life. I will attach tendons to you and make flesh come upon you and cover you with skin. I will put breath in you, and you will come to life. Then you will know that I am the Lord.'" As Ezekiel speaks the word of God, the Spirit works. It's another example of how the word and the Spirit work together, of the means that the Spirit uses in order to do his work of raising people from the deadness of sin. And we look around today and we perhaps look at our nation, we look at our society, perhaps we look at many of our churches, and we see nothing but spiritual barrenness, deadness. We engage with folks who can seem beyond the pale in terms of their understanding and responsiveness to the gospel. We see lives that are hardened by sin and cynicism, by distrust and disappointment, and we wonder, can they live? Can life really come back to a country like this that seems to have gone so far away from God and shut off God in so many aspects and at so many levels of its existence? Can people who have been layered and layered and layered with a message of hostility to the gospel and to faith and a distrust of the Christian message, who have become so soaked in sin, can they live spiritually? Well, the sovereign Lord alone knows. But our call is to speak the word of God to them, to speak to the dry bones, to communicate the gospel, to transmit to them the wonderful message of hope in Jesus Christ, and to pray that as we do, God's Spirit will come upon them and give them life and raise them from spiritual death. That's how it works. We bring the word of God And God in His sovereignty applies the Spirit. And even as that new life is imparted, God's ultimate promise is revealed at the end of chapter 37 and verse 24. My servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd. They will follow my laws and be careful to keep my decrees. They will live in the land I gave to my servant Jacob, the land where your fathers lived. They and their children and their children's children will live there forever. And David, my servant, will be their prince forever. I will make a covenant of peace with them. It will be an everlasting covenant. I will establish them and increase their numbers. And I will put my sanctuary among them forever. My dwelling place will be with them. I will be their God, and they will be my people. Then the nations will know that I, the Lord, make Israel holy when my sanctuary is among them forever. A new king reigning over a people who are secure, in peace, a time and a place where God will once again reign among his people, a people made holy, verse 28, by God himself. Chapters 40 to 48, we finish with Ezekiel's great priestly vision of that time, of that new sanctuary, of that new dwelling place, of that new temple. But before we get there to Ezekiel and indeed our conclusion of this great book, just note that there's an interlude in chapters 38 and 39. We are introduced to Gog from Magog. Can't help but smile when I say that. And we have in these chapters an account of a future attack by Israel's enemies upon Israel. Chapter 38 and verse 16. Gog is spoken of as leading this great advance against my people like a cloud that covers the land. In days to come, O Gog, I will bring you against my land so that the nations may know when I show myself holy through you before their eyes. Gog heads up this great alliance of nations, seven of them in total, enemies who will come against Israel in the future and destroy and plunder God's people. But the chapters tell us that in the day of that attack, God himself will summon up a sword against Gog, chapter 38 and verse 21. I will summon a sword against Gog. On all my mountains, declares the sovereign Lord, every man's sword will be against his brother. I will execute judgment upon him with plague and bloodshed. I will pour down torrents of rain, hailstones and burning sulfur on him and on his troops, and on the many nations with him. And then finally, on that day I will give Gog a burial place in Israel, in the valley of those who travel east towards the sea. It will block the way of travellers because Gog and all his hordes will be buried there. Many in church history have had a go at identifying Gog, trying to pin his identity on people in history. Gog wasn't a historical figure of Ezekiel's time, but this is a vision looking to the future, of course. In the 4th century, some of the early church fathers thought that Gog might be the Goths who were coming in and doing a bit of pillaging and no doubt destroying a few churches on the way. In the 7th century, it was the Arabs. In the 13th century, it was the Mongols. And in the 20th century, it was Russia and the communists. All quite good fun, but very much missing the point of why Gog is here in these chapters. You see, Gog is the name given to the forces mustered against God's people in a general representative sense. We see that in Revelation chapter 20, where Gog comes up at the very end of the Bible. When the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. In number they are like the sand in the seashore. They marched across the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of God's people, the city he loves. But fire came down from heaven and devoured them. and the devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of burning sulfur. You see, Gog is very much a stereotypical figure. He is there to embody all the forces of hostility that ever were and will be against God and against his people. A bit like the city of Babylon. You know, Gog is not an individual any more than Babylon is to be thought of as a particular geographical location. He represents a whole, a system, a body, a structure, a world in opposition to God. Gog is all the hostility against God and God's people that exists in this world. And just as in Revelation, God is declaring to Ezekiel and the exiles that the enemies against them will not prevail and will not triumph, but God will have the final victory. The exiles are to be reassured, indeed promised, that they will have future deliverance, that God will protect his people, that they need not fear the threats and attacks that will inevitably come, and inevitably do come, to the people of God. But there will be only one victor and one outcome, the triumph of God and of the Lamb. And that is our hope as Christians in a world that is becoming, it seems to us anyway, ever more hostile towards Christianity, to the things of God, to the people of God, where we feel the chill wind of that cynicism and movement against us to take away our freedoms and our rights. And how far that will go, we don't know. But we can see ominous signs that ultimately God will prevail. God will protect his people. That God will triumph over Gog and all those who follow in that wake, who are part of that system to oppress the people of God. And even as Ezekiel gives us that assurance, we reach the climax of his book. Chapters 40 to 48, we're going to do this quickly. A vision for the house of Israel, chapter 40 and verse 4. A vast new temple area. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody, but that is an illustration of the temple that Ezekiel is shown in these chapters. He's taken round it on a kind of tour, and the measurements are laid out and described to him. Almost imagine it like one of these kind of digital, virtual computer things that you go into, and it kind of builds the temple and the structure around you as you go round, and it gives you a kind of virtual tour of what God is building. It almost seems a bit like that when you look at Ezekiel's vision. The temple back in Jerusalem is in smoke and ashes, but here is something new, something greater, something to look forward to. And the temple complex in which Ezekiel is given a tour of in these chapters is vast. It is miles long in its dimensions. It is a temple to be preached and proclaimed rather than built. There are actually no vertical measurements. I think there might be one vertical measurement in all the descriptions of this temple. So it's very much a kind of outline. It's not an architect's drawing, something that was intended to be constructed. And indeed, it never was, of course, even when the people went back to Israel in later years. Its design is all about separation and boundaries and order. It is showing Ezekiel that out of the chaos and the mess of old Israel, where all the boundary lines had been broken down in the temple, remember some of those visions of the inside of the temple we looked at last week, that in place of that in the future, a new temple would be established where balance and boundaries and order and propriety would once again be established in the affairs of God's people and in the worship of God himself. In chapter 42, verse 20, we have a description of the great outer wall that went round this whole kind of vast complex, and we get an idea from it of what the purpose was. So he measured the area on all four sides and had a wall around it, 500 cubits long and 500 cubits wide, to separate the holy from the common. And in these chapters, if we were to read them through, we would see the restoration of feasts and sacrifices. We would see priests being re-instructed in their conduct and given different responsibilities. We would see the division of the land of Israel being parcelled out again, given equally to the tribes with the instructions that they are never to sell it because it is the Lord's land. And in chapter 47, we would see a river that flowed out of this temple across the nation, across the land itself, bringing healing and fruitfulness and revival to it. But key to it all, and what makes it, what makes this the completion of Ezekiel's journey and ministry, because this is a vision which is 20 years after the first vision back in chapter 1, is what we read in chapter 43, verses 1 to 5, that Ian has already alluded to tonight. Then the man brought me to the gate facing east, and I saw the glory of God, the glory of the God of Israel coming from the east. His voice was like the roar of rushing waters, and the land was radiant with his glory. The vision I saw was like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city, and like the visions I had seen by the Kibar River, and I fell face down. The glory of the Lord entered the temple through the gate facing east. Then the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. The glory that had departed in chapter 11 has returned again. God once again is going to dwell with his people. And that would be a good place to stop. We've come full circle in that regard in our study in Ezekiel. The temple destroyed has now been renewed. The chaos of the past has now been replaced by the order of the future. The land once defiled is now cleansed. The glory that departed has now returned. But it's a temple, as you read through these chapters, where sin is still an issue. There are warnings about it. Chapter 43 and verse 9. The people in this temple are warned, now let them put away from me their prostitution and their lifeless idols of their kings, and I will live among them forever. It's a temple where sacrifices for sin are still to be made. Then he said to me, Son of man, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. These will be the regulations for sacrificing burnt offerings and sprinkling blood upon the altar when it is built. You are to give a young bull as a sin offering to the priests. It's a temple where sins are still committed. See that in the next slide. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. In the first month, in the first day, you are to take a young bull without defect and purify the sanctuary. The priest is to take some of the blood of the sin offering and put it on the doorpost of the temple, on the four corners of the upper ledge of the altar, and on the gatepost of the inner court. You are to do the same in the seventh day of the month for anyone who sins unintentionally or through ignorance. You are to make atonement for the temple. It's a temple where there are still no-go areas. There's no instructions about going into the Holy of Holies. Some have seen that as a sense that that has now been cut off. And so even as this great vision of the temple in these last chapters takes us forward, takes Ezekiel forward out of the sin and chaos of old Israel, it still leaves us short. Because to be completely secure, to be completely safe, to be completely at ease with God, we need that sin issue dealt with once and for all. Because while that sin issue remains, there's always the problem that perhaps things will go back to the bad old days. That perhaps once again this temple will have to be destroyed itself. Perhaps once again the people will be thrown out of the place of God's dwelling. That perhaps once again the glory will need to depart. It's interesting, isn't it? Right at the start of Jesus' ministry, and at the end of Jesus' ministry, he goes into the temple and he symbolically has to cleanse it. Still not right. Because we need a new temple. We need a temple where sin can never spoil again. In AD 70, the last Jewish temple was destroyed, just as Jesus had predicted it would. In Matthew 24, there is no Jewish temple anymore. On the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, where it used to stand as the third most holy place in Islam, the Dome of the Rock, a great mosque. And all the Jews today can do is go to that western wall at the side of the mount, the Wailing Wall, and make their prayers and mourn over the fact that the temple is no longer there. And who's going to destroy the third most holy site in Islam to rebuild it? And we see God's providence in that, don't we? Because God's people had a new temple in AD 70 and have a new temple today. Jesus Christ Himself. Jesus Himself was the place where sin would be dealt with once and for all. He Himself was the place of that sacrifice that at the end of the age would take away sins forever in a never to be repeated sacrifice. Jesus Himself is the place and the focus of our worship now. Jesus Himself is the location of God's glory and presence. As we thought this morning, we beheld His glory. The glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. In Him dwells the fullness of the Godhead bodily. He is the location of God's presence now. He is where we meet with God. He is that sacrifice. He is that place, that focus of our worship. It's why when we go to Revelation 22, and with this we will finish our thoughts on Ezekiel, we read, in that great city inhabited by the people of God in the ages to come, I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. No more sin hanging over us, undermining us, threatening us. No more restrictions, every barrier torn down, every enemy defeated. Book of Isaiah of Ezekiel finishes with these words, the very last verse. And the name of the city from that time on will be, the Lord is there, Jesus is there. Hallelujah. And may God bless His word to us.